Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of President Obama's strategic plans to combat the Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria from Steve Clemens, who is Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. We'll discuss the missing element in the president's plans, and that is the Sunni buy-in, since so far we'll be working with the Iranians and the hated government in Baghdad against the Sunnis in Iraq in what appears to be shaping up as a boon for private military contractors and a boost for the Democrats in the upcoming midterm elections, but a bust for any durable solution to a region that the Bush-Cheney administration broke and which the Obama administration is unlikely to be able to fix. Then we'll go to Beirut to speak with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, a fellow at the Century Foundation who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe. We'll examine an increasingly deadly and intractable civil war next door in Syria, further inflamed by the beheading of a third Western hostage by the Islamic State, which is likely to draw the United States further into a conflict involving 1,500 rival militia groups fighting amongst themselves and occasionally against the Assad regime, that has resulted in the deaths of over 200,000 Syrians, the destruction of the country, and the displacement of a third of Syria's population. Then finally, as the CIA gears up to enter into a third war in Iraq and get more involved in Syria, we will look into the war at home between the CIA and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence over the long-delayed report on the agency's use of torture and rendition during the Bush-Cheney presidency. Ali Watkins, who is with the McClatchy Washington Bureau, where she covers national security and the intelligence agencies, joins us to discuss her recent article at McClatchy, New Sparks Fly Between CIA, Senate Intelligence Committee, that indicates many senators are furious with the CIA over their disrespectful attitude towards the committee that Senator Levin describes as arrogant and unacceptable. Joining us now is Steve Clemens, who is Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously he co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
Thank you, Ian.
And in terms of the president's speech this last week and actions since then, and John Kerry's peripatetic efforts to get the various Arab and Gulf states on side, excluding Iran, and of course Turkey was at that important meeting but refused to sign the communique, how would you say President Obama's team is doing in terms of organizing the neighborhood against the Islamic State?
Well, not well. I think we're sputtering along. I think that there are some, like the Australians and the British and others, that are likely to come into this coalition. But the problem with it is that the fuel that is driving ISIS in part is the notion that they are important enough in the region, important enough as a representative of disaffected Sunni interests, that they alone can effectively challenge, you know, the Westerners can challenge America, and that they are the ones that are inviting a response. So in a way, the things that John Kerry and President Obama and Chuck Hagel have been doing so far are legitimating ISIS, not undermining it, and that's a huge problem. So some thought has to go into Sunni nation and Sunni tribal participation in this effort, and not just participation in its lowest common form, but in a maximalist way. There needs to be Saudi and UAE and Kuwaiti and other involvement. There need to be Iraqi Sunni tribal leaders who are helping to drive this process. And if that doesn't happen, our steps inadvertently, no matter how many of these people we kill, it inadvertently makes them bigger and more legitimate. And that's missing in the president's response so far, and it's disappointing.
Well, so far, Steve Clemens, it would seem that that if we start killing the Islamic State, we'll be doing it alongside the Iranians. Already there were Iranian boots on the ground in the liberation of Amali, and the Iraqi Shiite militias have joined the fight, so it looks as though we'll be working with both Iran and the Shiite militias, and the Iraqi Air Force, for what it is, has done some bombing incredibly inaccurately, all of which has fed into the ISIS narrative. They've shown pictures of the collateral damage. So why is it then that we can't work with the very people, the only people that they're on the ground that have an alliance of convenience at the moment with the Islamic State, and that are the tribes, Sunni tribes, the very people that saved President Bush's bacon with the surge, the so-called awakening. Why aren't we working with them as opposed to these other people who will, in fact, probably exacerbate the problem and alienate the Sunnis further?
It's a very hard question to answer. I think that one response is that we have a sloppy approach. I think another approach is that, at least in the way this has become a very public challenge, and that many Americans are interested in this right now, it's harder to take steps with certain groups that also look bad. I mean, I tell everybody there are no good guys in this, in any of this. Even the so-called, you know, moderate crowd in the FSA inside Syria, they're beheading people too. So it's one of these things where you have shades of gray of bad, and our political system wants to see black hats and white hats. And I think ultimately, you're right, we need to work with tribal leaders inside Iraq who were disaffected. You know, 2.5 years ago, Maliki inside Iraq ran the Sunni vice president, Tariq al-Hashimi, out of the country, charged him with murder, was going to do this. This was a vice president of the country who was really the reigning head at that moment of Sunni interests inside the country. I've met him a number of times. I, you know, don't want to speak to the veracity of the claims because I don't believe them necessarily. But nonetheless, at that moment, that was the spark 2.5 years ago of what became a civil war inside that country, what has become a civil war. And it was at that moment that the U.S. and other stakeholders in the Iraqi equation should have moved more expeditiously on the question of Maliki and his unrepresentative government, and should have taken stock that the Sunnis were being squeezed out of influence at that point. And so this is a manifestation. What we're seeing, you know, those tribal leaders, they don't trust us. They don't trust the Shiites in Baghdad. Of course, they don't trust Iran. And what you just outlined with us joining up with these teams feeds a paranoia among Sunni tribesmen that we've gone in and we basically took out Saddam Hussein and gave Iraq to Iran. Many Saudi leaders believe that, and as they look in the region, you know, as we're trying to do nuclear deals within Iran and other things, they fear that America is either weak or incompetent or allied with their enemies, and you know, you can pick any box, and that is changing their behavior, and that is a huge, huge problem.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, he co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. So how much then has the president been buffaloed into this by the punditry? Because I don't know where it all came from, but suddenly, all of a sudden, the president was out of touch. He was feckless. He was weak. He was a vacillator. He didn't have a strategy. And now he's had to take to the airwaves and assert himself. And I'm sure what he's doing now is probably helping the Democratic Party in this forthcoming midterm election, at which they're not supposed to be doing very well. So is this a case of a very thoughtful president being forced to abandon the brains for the brawn?
Well, I think that the jury's still out. I think to some degree I was impressed with the ability of the White House and the president to maintain strategic restraint and to realize that most of these problems in the Middle East, as they're constructed right now, are ones where it's very, very hard for the U.S. military to play a tipping point role. And by injecting force, whether it's aerial bombardment or its special operations forces or whatever, its advisors in Iraq, these troops and forces are very difficult to have it, you know, to make a definitive difference in the balance and the equation there. So I think that I had been impressed with that. I think now what's happened is the American popular support for military action has grown so dramatically, in contrast to, as you recall, and you and I talked about it at the time, the case in Syria, where we were about to take action in Syria. That was Labor Day weekend last year, and There was no support in this country for military action. So those beheading videos made a huge change in the American public appetite for action, and that thus is political. And this is a season in which we're, you know, marching towards a an election here in November in which the Democrats look as if they're going to be doing very bad. So I don't want to say the president is doing this exclusively for political reasons. There are other drivers, but it certainly isn't hurting his shift into this direction.
But does it trouble you, Steve Clemons, that there's a sort of echo of bin Laden in this, in the sense that we took bin Laden's bait after 9/11 and did exactly what he wanted, which was to have Christian armies on Muslim lands, and it's as though we played right into bin Laden's playbook? And the, given that these beheadings, and the third one, of course, has added fuel to this, and there's a young woman that they have, an American woman, another aid worker in the pipeline to be beheaded. So I'm just wondering whether, again, we are taking the bait.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that one of the things that are, I mean, the ISIS videos are doing thing. One, the ISIS videos are taunting the West, so inviting them in, if you will. And the other thing is ISIS is playing its own shock and awe campaign as a way to attract recruits and as a way to scare its opponents. And when you draw in military forces, whether of any kind, in into this region, it becomes a recruiting mania for the other side. And we saw in Afghanistan, as we were, you know, increasing the size of our troops and forces inside Afghanistan, with the various levels of surges that we had there, the designated Taliban combatants would, you know, increase by about the same proportion. And so a Western military footprint comes in into this region, and it does antagonize, and it increases the support for these monsters. That's why having a Sunni spearhead at the front of this is vital, and it's the missing key piece.
So people like DynCorp and others will probably be the boots on the ground, won't they? And the contractors, they have that deniability, right? Is that what's going to happen, do you think?
I think it could be a part of it. I fear that because, you know, certainly the region looks at those people as U.S.-led agents no matter what. So we don't get off in terms of their perception of what we're sending over there. And the other thing we've seen with a lot of the private military contractors is that the rules of engagement are very different from the U.S. military. The U.S. military generates collateral damage, but at least there's some, you know, guilt and concern about that. On the military contracting side, there's a lot less guilt and concern.
So in terms of this idea of trying to maintain perhaps an illusion that Iraq is a unitary state, now it would seem to me that what's at stake here is, of course, if the country breaks up, then the Iran, which is the winner so far of the Iraq war, will basically end up having tremendous influence over the part of the southern part that has most of the oil. So that's probably not in the U.S. interest. The Kurds have already gone their own way, which has made the Turks a little leery, but they seem to be adjusting to it. My understanding is that there's something like 20 million Kurds inside of Turkey and about 13 million inside of Iran. So what is the reason, and if it does break up, the Sunnis seem to be the odd man out. They don't get any of the resources, as far as I can tell. So what are the pressures, the fact that the U.S. and Iran are on the same page of trying to maintain this idea that Iraq is a unitary state, and yet they are at loggerheads over so many other issues? So what is the common interest?
The United States is fearful that if it creates fully ethnic divisions, whether they are loosely federated or you develop a kind of independent section like you have in Kurdistan and whatnot, that if you take that a step further, you put into place something that would be fairly dramatic for the region, is that lots of other groups would begin trying to rewrite the lines in the region around their ethnic identities. And, of course, that has fueled groups like the Russians, who've tried to also use the notion of ethnic majorities as a justification for separatist movements. So I think that's part of the fear that the White House has, but I don't think that they're necessarily on the same page with Iran and wanting to keep it the whole state. I think that they're, you know, for the same reasons, I think that fundamentally there's a fear that if you launch in place something in one part of the region, it'll become a justification for further separatist movements elsewhere.
But I recall that it was none other than Vice President Joe Biden, who some time back, in fact, years ago.
Yeah, I mean, he and Les Gelb had the Biden-Gelb plan that advocated, you know, a federation of three autonomous regions, but they were short of full states.
Mm-hmm. But did he? Do you think that's still swirling around in the background?
Well, I think in a way you almost have a de facto reality of that now. I mean, I think that, you know, they're trying to hold the government together, but I don't know if al-Badi's government will survive these challenges or not. Fundamentally, there are a lot of steps left to sort of see what happens in the Middle East. But right now, Kurdistan, which is the key player in this, if Kurdistan stays in the mix, Iraq will remain united. If Kurdistan says, we tried to work with Maliki and he screwed us, and our deal with the United States was as long as we kind of approached something that would be a genuine give and take between the regions and something that approximated a genuine democracy, Kurdistan would play along. But the moment that it didn't, Kurdistan has been saying, it's time for us to consider different options. And I think that there are more and more, including, surprisingly, even the Turkish government, but also, strangely, it's the Israeli government, have said maybe it's time for Kurdistan to become independent. If Kurdistan were to move along that track to independence, it starts a domino effect that could be very, very dramatic in the region and cut into a lot of countries.
Well, just in closing, Turkey has not signed on the communique that came out of the meeting in Jeddah with all the foreign ministers of the region. Turkey, of course, has a complication with 50 hostages being held by the Islamic State, diplomatic hostages that were captured in Mosul. And also, Turkey must be aware of the blowback. They were very permissive in allowing these jihadis to show up in the first place in Syria. So what's going on with Erdogan, do you think? Does he have some buyer's remorse for being so permissive with the formation of the Islamic State?
Certainly with the border thing, but you know, he didn't create the Islamic State, in my view. A lot of Saudi private money had a lot to do with it, as well as a lot of, you know, was a precursor with it, you know, had a precursor with Zarqawi's previous group inside Iraq. But, you know, they certainly had a kind of Wild West attitude that everybody could come and go in the Turkish-Syria border, because ISIS and the al-Nusra Front and some of these other Islamic groups may not have been our allies, but they were also fighting Bashar al-Assad. And at that point, you had a broad wink and nod that anybody that was taking on Bashar al-Assad was okay. And it was turning out that the moderates we frequently talk about were feckless and ineffective and constantly in you know, tied up in knots that they had made themselves. We saw FSA commanders selling, you know, the weapons that the French and Turks were giving them, selling them to al-Nusra and ISIS. So you had something there that while people didn't like the radical Islamist groups, and you had people like Martin Dempsey, then Joint Chiefs of Staff, warning about these groups for a period of time, I think that that none of these countries, including the Turks, viewed ISIS as the threat it would become, and they thought it was directed at Assad, and that ultimately they would be manageable if they had, in fact, managed to topple Assad. So that's the complexity here, is that there was a coalition of the willing, if you will, against Assad, and that one of these big groups broke in a different direction.
Well, Steve Clements, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clements, who's a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, he co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to Beirut, Lebanon, to get a update on what's happening next door in Syria.
جيت النفجوز عيونه هالصمار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Beirut is a Lebanese-based journalist, Sanasi Kambanis, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation. He writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at sanasiskambanis.com. He's the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his new book, out soon, is Once Upon a Revolution, which is about the Egyptian Revolution and the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
It's always good to talk to you, even though it's usually about bad news.
Well, it's certainly bad news for the family of the Scottish aid worker who was just executed by the Islamic State, apparently in the same location as the two American journalists, which is, I take it, somewhere in Syria, near where you are, Thanasi. What's your sense that where things stand? One of the more extraordinary stories that I'm still trying to pin down, and I thought maybe you might have something on that, is the killing of the leader of one of the Islamic groups, one of the more effective ones, who was killed along with 50 of his top lieutenants in a basement in a highly secure facility where they were apparently killed by some sophisticated chemical weapon. And there was some doubt as to whether it was done by the Islamic State, who'd previously killed some of the members, or whether it was done by the Assad regime. What's the latest on that?
Well, that's the leadership of Ahrar al-Sham, which is one of the, as you said, one of the more powerful militias. It's a militia that the U.S. was not willing to work with because of its Islamist ideology, but it fell short of falling into the al-Qaeda camp. And as the Syrian revolutionaries became more and more fundamentalist, Ahrar al-Sham began to look better and better by comparison. And in the last year, they had emerged as one of the few effective groups that actually fighting both the regime and the Islamic State, and that's why they were so vigorously targeted. No one actually knows whether they were killed by the Islamic State or by the regime, and frankly, either explanation makes sense in the sort of perverted situation we're in now. I mean, the Syrian regime is very happy to take advantage of the West's hysteria over the Islamic State to focus on its more moderate rivals. And at the same time, the Islamic State is surely trying to get rid of its closest enemies before it's going to have to deal with a U.S.-led series of airstrikes.
Well, this leads you to wonder about who are we going to be working with there? Whose side is anybody on there? It's so hard to tell.
And this is a huge problem, right? Because, you know, from the vantage point of the region, there's a whole bunch of actors who are just aghast at the rise of the Islamic State. And these are actors like the Iranians and Hamas and Hezbollah, and we can fill out the list. But these are actors who are not in any way allied with Western interests, but for this question of the Islamic State. And on that question, they're willing to cheer anybody who can decapitate or thwart or degrade the capabilities of the Islamic State. But this array of anti-Islamic State factions, they don't have a lot in common with themselves, and they have very little in common with the U.S. So we're likely to see situations where, let's say, Iran and Hezbollah or Saudi Arabia are tacitly cheering on the U.S. as it bombs the Islamic State in one redoubt or another, and at the same time they'll be funding or working otherwise to undermine the allies that the U.S. is working with on the ground, and that's gonna mean that this initiative, this sort of renewed war on terror, is going to go very poorly. And one other really key sort of fundamental problem that's cooked into the foundations of this is that the U.S. has decided to ally with more or less anybody who's not an al-Qaeda terrorist and who's against the Islamic State. And that means it's willing to work with authoritarians and death squads from the sort of nice-ish authoritarians in Iraqi Kurdistan to the unappealing Shia sectarian militias in Iraq and on to a wide array of Syrian rebels who we didn't trust 6 months ago, but now out of necessity are willing to trust. And these are not high quality, reliable or liberal partners.
Again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, who is in Beirut, where he's a Lebanese-based journalist and a fellow at the Century Foundation. He writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasikambanis.com. He's the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book out soon is Once Upon a Revolution, which is about the Egyptian revolution after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. So, in terms of the murkiness of the idea that we're picking sides when amongst the opposition, the Syrian opposition, the armed opposition, they're fighting amongst themselves as well as fighting Assad. They're apparently, according to the Director of National Intelligence, there's about 1,500 units or factions variously named. So sorting through that mosaic, and then on top of that, from the executions of the first two American journalists, my understanding is that the employer of James Foley thought they were dealing with Syrian Air Force intelligence, only to have Foley handed over to ISIS, and the family of Steve Sotolov believed they were dealing with elements of the Free Syrian Army, only to find him handed over to ISIS. So it seems that what's going on there, you can't sort of pass out the criminality from the factions and the political and military factions. So how is the Obama administration going to spend $500 million arming and training these people when they seem to be both unreliable and amazingly duplicitous?
Well, so this sort of leads us to the question of what does it make sense to try to do, and what are realistic expectations? Let's start with the things that I think reasonable people can agree on. One is that the U.S. has to be involved one way or another, right? We can't just ignore the entrenchment and rising of a fundamentalist petro state that is more extreme than al-Qaeda. We can't just ignore the Syrian civil war and try to contain it from a country's remove and hope that it won't spill over the borders and create strategic problems. So we can't not be involved. But also another thing we can't do is embrace the fiction that somehow through force we can erase a movement like the Islamic State. Let's remember that in more than a decade of throwing every resource we had, we were unable to dismantle the much smaller al-Qaeda network. And let's also keep in mind that there is a deep well of dissatisfaction against among reactionary Sunnis throughout not just Syria and Iraq, but the wider region. And this is actually a constituency that is somewhat sympathetic to the Islamic State. So we're not dealing with a tiny fringe phenomenon that we can somehow corner and contain and wipe out. So that leads to what can we do? And I think, unfortunately, the policies that make sense to follow are politically a little bit hard for the Obama administration to embrace. But one is to treat this as I think it should be, as a police and intelligence problem, and to say that through steady intelligence work and police work, we will try to chip away at the ability of the Islamic State to hurt people, knowing that that's a long, slow project and one which can never be completely executed. The other one, which they're not even going to try and do, unfortunately, is to acknowledge that the underlying problem is a deficit of political accountability and representative politics throughout the region. And until that is redressed, we're going to continue to see nihilistic, violent, fundamentalist movements gaining traction and gaining power. And we're about to make a series of moves that make that problem worse, because in the process of doing battle against the Islamic State, partnering with the sort of least bad elements in the neighborhood, we're going to further entrench reactionary, authoritarian, local warlords, and we're going to end up in a region where you have the choices are between dictators like Bashar al-Assad and the Ayatollahs in Iran, or smaller scale local warlords who are somehow defined by the West as moderate, but who in fact are often more fundamentalist than the dictatorships we're talking about.
So what's going to happen then in terms of if and when the U.S. decides to bomb in Syria? The Assad regime is saying, you know, you're welcome to bomb, but you got to get our permission first and work with us on who you bomb. The Russians have said that the U.S. can't bomb until they have approval from the U.N. Security Council, over which they and China have veto power. So that's a dead end. So my sense is, and you're in the neighborhood, are the Alawites and the Christians and the minorities that are loyal to Assad beginning to wonder whether this guy's worth all the trouble he's brought? I mean, if he can't guarantee their security, is he still as solid as ever? In other words, could you make a deal where through the Russians and the Iranians, you sort of send him off to, you know, dictator's retirement home in some lavish retirement?
Well, you've raised two very good questions that I'll take as separate things because I think they're both big questions. And the first one is, what happens if and when America decides to bomb Syria? And I think the fallout from that is going to be potentially worse and more destabilizing than we can imagine. Because let's suppose that Iran and Russia and Syria will maybe be happy to see the Islamic State weaken, but we're not even sure of that because they found the Islamic State to be quite a convenient bugbear, a convenient enemy. But let's say they're happy to see that. At the same time, they're going to be absolutely delighted to capitalize on that, to reframe the civil war that they have started as an American aggression in the Islamic world. And they're going to use that, I fear, successfully to fashion themselves as the victims of another imperialist American war. And they're going to use that to whitewash years of criminal, nearly perhaps genocidal behavior. And that's, you know, it's sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't position for America, because if they do something about the Islamic State, they're at the same time going to give a lot of wind to very noxious regimes. And that leads to your other question, which is, again, another great question, is, you know, what does this say about Bashar Assad's longevity? And again, I'm afraid I see his very sort of noxiously self-serving strategy as having worked to his advantage. I mean, for the last 3 years, he has focused all his regime's firepower not on the most dangerous rebels, but on the most moderate rebels. To wipe them out and to leave as the only alternative to his regime the most extreme caricature of Islamism. So he can say truthfully that his regime, no matter what else it is a pluralistic regime that protects minorities. And if you topple him, what are you going to get? You're going to get the caliph. Which would you prefer? And I think, sadly, more and more Syrians are willing to let Bashar survive rather than risk life under Caliph Baghdadi. And I think Russia and Iran have found in Bashar al-Assad a pliant and useful ally and proxy. And so I don't think they're going to have a lot of incentive to replace him with some, you know, perhaps better dictator.
But in militarily, though, what's happening? Because my understanding is that the Islamic State or ISIL have moved a lot of the equipment, the latest American equipment that they captured from the Iraqi army that disintegrated. And you've seen pictures of them driving these tanks around Raqqa, along with pictures of them crucifying people in the town square. So my understanding is that they've actually made some military advances against Assad thanks to this new American military equipment.
I haven't studied in great detail the map of the battlefield in Syria in the last 2 weeks. But my impression from what I have followed is that both the regime and the Islamic State have continued to spend the majority of their firepower against the so-called moderate opposition. So there might, well, I mean, there have been reports of the regime for the first time striking some ISIS targets, and there have been some reports of ISIS actually fighting the regime. But for the most part, what we've seen is the continuing focus on annihilation of the Syrian opposition that is not ISIS. or Islamic State, excuse me, is their new name. And so my impression is that the important, you know, the well-armed powers, the regime, the Syrian regime and the Islamic State, seem to have a continuing incentive to try and wipe out the middle ground. And furthermore, if the regime were to actually make a serious effort to deracinate the Islamic State, which they have by no stretch of the imagination have they begun to do that, if they were, I think they'd be hard-pressed to make any effective fight. I mean, keep in mind, you know, the Kurdish Peshmerga, who are one of the better fighting forces in the region, were getting overrun until the U.S. Came in full-fledged to do airstrikes in coordination with the Peshmerga. This was the U.S. working with a trusted military ally that it has 20 years of continuous working history with. So imagine what, in contrast, what the Syrian regime would be able to do. I think they would fail miserably, and that we're sooner or later going to be faced with the very scary prospect that even when the major powers try, the Islamic State is going to be a much more formidable military enemy than any of the resistance groups that we've seen states doing battle with in the last 12 years.
So if indeed both the Assad regime and the Islamic State have been concentrating their firepower on the moderate opposition in Syria, the very people that we're supposed to arm once we can identify them, and I'm not sure what the vetting process is here, but these people have got to be beleaguered. You know, this civil war's gone on for a long time. At least 200,000 people have died. I think a third of the people in Syria have been internally displaced or are in camps in Turkey and Jordan. So if the U.S. comes up with this $500 million package, and my understanding is the last time we armed the Syrian moderate opposition, all of the arms were stolen out of warehouses in Turkey, and they ended up with the group that just was assassinated. So walk us through that, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think quite clearly we have to accept that to have influence in this conflict, the U.S. is going to have to arm a lot of these groups. And if they arm these groups, a lot of the weapons that they give them and the money they give them is going to be stolen and misused. I think that's a cost of doing business in this theater, and we have to accept that, and we have to design our aid in such a way that if it gets misused, it's not going to ruin our strategic environment. I mean, and what do I mean by this? I think a logical train and equip program is going to focus on things like RPGs and machine guns, anti-aircraft guns, cash. Things that help a small rebel movement fight effectively. It ought not to include game-changing weapons like, you know, surface-to-air missiles and things that, if they got in the wrong hands, could end up being a big problem for the U.S. And let's remember that the big change in status for ISIS wasn't misused weapons that the Americans sent the FSA, which were stolen out of a warehouse. It was the huge arsenal of heavy weaponry that the U.S. gave the Iraqi military and which was captured in June when Mosul fell. Those Humvees and those tanks and Apaches and so on and so forth, those are the huge thing that has changed the capacity of the Islamic State, and those have nothing to do with the kind of aid we've been giving to the rebels. And the other thing to bear in mind is that, you know, the majority of these people fighting are not appealing characters with a sophisticated politics. It's a misnomer, as I did a minute ago, even to refer to them as moderate. But they're not moderate. Some of them are less fundamentalist than others or less corrupt than others. But on the whole, they are religiously conservative, politically unsophisticated, and corrupt local warlords. So by aiding them, we're conceding that we're operating in a very undesirable and imperfect environment, and we're hoping that by arming and training these groups, we gain some new leverage or control or ability to manipulate their political program. But it has to be done with open eyes and no sort of naive sense that these are Democrats in the making or reformers in the making, because I think there's no evidence to support that idea.
Well, just in closing, Thanasi Kambanis, the execution of the 44-year-old British aid worker who was just executed by the Islamic State, and he is the father of two. His murderer said that they were killing him because the British had supported the Peshmerga. And my understanding is that the Peshmerga are the only people so far that have been willing to take on the Islamic State. The Islamic State in Syria have put out a fatwa on them saying that they were heretics, and they've been fighting. And I've seen some rather amazing footage of Peshmerga women fighters fighting these women-hating Islamists. So the fact that they made that statement in executing the British aid worker, that would mean, it would indicate that Peshmerga's got them worried.
Well, I mean, I think if I don't know how smart their own threat analysis is, but I think what they should be worried about is having provoked, having gone so far as to do maybe the only things that would successfully unite their enemies against them. Because, you know, for the previous year, by more or less laying low and focusing on killing locally other rival Sunni groups, it seemed the world was content to let them alone. And by first making this huge feint into the heartland of Iraq, and then secondly, by so actively provoking and taunting the Western governments to these grotesque beheadings, they are, perhaps this is part of their plan, I don't know, but it certainly is not the smart thing to do if you're interested in self-preservation of your movement. It might help them recruit more volunteers, but it's absolutely helping to focus not only the rage of their immediate neighbors like the Peshmerga, but the attention of Western policymakers who until now have really ignored this conflict. And so we see, I mean, you're talking about the Peshmerga, and we see right there the U.S. and others suddenly putting a lot of time and money and thought into how to help the Peshmerga, and that's good if you want to stop ISIS. That's bad if you're ISIS trying to build yourself a new state. I think probably their self-destructive overreach and self-delusional arrogance is going to be a help to thwarting and containing them in the long term.
But the other side of the coin is that bin Laden, in attacking us on 9/11, we swallowed the bait and did exactly what he wanted, which was to have Christian armies on Islamic lands. So I don't know whether they're baiting us and how much we're swallowing the bait. But I thank you for joining us, Thanasi Kambanis.
It's always interesting, if depressing, to talk to you.
Okay, well, I'll try. Next time, I hope we have something more pleasant to talk about. Again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation. He writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasiskambanis.com. He's the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book out soon is Once Upon a Revolution, which is about the Egyptian revolution after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak, and he joined us from Beirut. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the war at home between the CIA and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ali Watkins, who's with the McClatchy Washington Bureau, where she covers national security and intelligence, and she has an article at McClatchy, New Sparks Fly Between CIA and Senate Intelligence Committee. It seems to me that at the end of the day, the CIA simply does not want this report to come out. Is that what's going on here?
You know, I don't know that that's it. You know, from what I've gathered, both sides would kind of like this to be over with. I think that what's become a bigger issue in this whole conversation has been everything that happened around the report. You know, because it's not just the report anymore. We have all these allegations of spying, and we have this incredible deterioration in the relationship between the agency and its congressional overseers, kind of as a product of this process of creating the report. So I don't know that it's so much the report, which is really what makes this situation interesting. It's more everything that's happened around it in these 4 or 5 years it took to compile it, and everything that happened in that relationship in between.
And, of course, the most recent thing that happened, at least the thing that got a lot of people's attention, was that the head of the CIA, John Brennan, had denied that the CIA had broken into the Senate Select Intelligence Committee's computers, apparently to try and find out who inside the agency was providing the material for this report on torture. He initially denied that, and then was eventually forced to admit that it was true and apologize. So I take it that relations are pretty tense between the senators, and at least some of the senators, and the director of Central Intelligence.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, again, is that this apology happened. You know, we saw this huge, I don't want to call it a scandal, but we saw this huge explosion in March of, you know, this allegation that the CIA had spied, and then the CIA fired back that some of Dianne Feinstein's staffers on her Senate Intelligence Committee had taken these classified documents in a manner that wasn't authorized. So we had this whole thing spill onto the forum in March, and obviously relations weren't good. And then we have this apology in July. And it's been interesting because you'd think that there have been all these little instances where, you know, maybe the situation would get better, or maybe, you know, this apology would help. But then again, we saw this past week in the story that we had on Friday that this relationship still seems to be stalled. And, you know, is it to a point where it's not going to be fixed until either side kind of changes? It's very interesting to see how, despite all the developments since, nothing's really been fixed. And from what I've gathered from people I've talked to, the relationship is even worse than it was, you know, 8 months ago or whatever it was in March.
So when Senator Carl Levin says, "I'm concerned there's disrespect towards the Congress," is that what is at the heart of this? You know, there was an old joke in the CIA about when they used to refer to the intelligence committees as the mushroom farm. We keep them in the dark, and every now and then we throw a bunch of manure on them. And is that attitude still prevailing? Is this about a sense that the CIA is just treating the senators with contempt?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Ian. I think the heart of this, you know, isn't so much the actions that have happened on the surface. It's this really gut debate over congressional oversight, you know, and where do those powers fall? You know, what's the power balance between the agency and its congressional overseers? And I think Carl Levin, along with several of his colleagues who were willing to go on the record in my piece on Friday, have really sense that is the heart of this issue, that it's not so much the report or these allegations, it's the fact that it doesn't appear to be a very balanced oversight process, at least when it comes to the Intelligence Committee and the agency.
Again, I'm speaking with Ali Watkins, who is with McClatchy's Washington Bureau in Washington, D.C., where she covers national security and intelligence matters, and she has a piece at McClatchy, New Sparks Fly Between CIA Senate Intelligence Committee. One of the things that I find extraordinary about this whole story, and we're talking here about a 6,000-page report on the CIA's rendition, detention, and interrogation program that's been in the works now for years. The committee has spent $40 million five years compiling this more than 6,000-page report. And we're talking about how the CIA have redacted it, they've delayed it, they've snooped on the Senate Intelligence Committee's computers to try and find out who inside the agency was leaking material that's in the report. And one of the things that I find extraordinary about the story itself, and I wondered if this has come across your radar here, is that the people involved in the torture program or the rendition program, the CIA's program, were largely those from the Latin American side who had had experience in Central America. And then for reasons which I'm not entirely clear on, they were then given the Iraq portfolio. There was nobody, and I've talked to a bunch of ex-CIA people like Bob Baer, who speaks Arabic, and others, that they are mystified as to why no Arabic speakers were on the program, and these were all came from the Latin American side of the CIA.
You know, as far as kind of gritty details like that, I haven't been very privy to that, but I think taking that kind of question and looking at it in this broad context, that's obviously one of the many questions that have come up in the aftermath of this program. And I think the real question with this report is whether it's going to answer those kinds of questions. You know, is it really going to close this chapter of us asking, you know, well, this was mismanaged and why, and this program was run in a way that wasn't, you know, really functional and it didn't adhere to American values and why? You know, are they going to answer those questions? Because we've seen people have criticized this program for years, and we've had several reports come out on it, including one from Carl Levin's Armed Services Committee, and yet we're still asking the questions. So I think the real question for Dianne Feinstein and her committee is what is this report going to do in this conversation? You know, is it going to give us that bookend and give us the answers, or is it going to leave us wondering again? And I'm really not sure what the answer is yet.
Well, the fellow that I was thinking about, his name is Rodriguez. He was the head of the program, and he wrote a book about it, in fact, and is not at all apologetic, whereas other people involved in the program, like Ali Soufan from the FBI, went public and said it was absolutely useless. No intelligence was gained from torture, and that you get a hell of a lot more out of prisoners by treating them respectfully as opposed to waterboarding them.
Mm-hmm.
How much, though, has the CIA tried to make the case, given what's happening now with the Islamic State and yet another beheading, this time of an Englishman? I don't know that you need any more excuses to make these people in the Middle East mad at the United States. They seem to be doing a pretty good job without anybody stirring up the hornet's nest. But my understanding is that one of the arguments, and perhaps it is going on behind the scenes, is that we simply can't release all this information about our torture program because it's just going to cause blowback and backlash.
That's actually a conversation that myself and several of my colleagues and, you know, other reporters I know on the Hill we've had, because everybody's just kind of shooting in the dark, you know, in terms of a release date here. And at the end of the day, it really is up to Senator Feinstein and the committee. But, you know, something that came up is do you think about releasing this report that, based on what we've heard about it, seriously draws the agency's credibility into question? And do you release that kind of thing? Do you drop that kind of bomb right as we're using, you know, intelligence as one of the justifications for stepping into this quote-unquote war with ISIS? So I think that timing is certainly something that's on their radar, and that it's very delicate given the current situation that we're having over there. So I don't know that there would ever be a good time to release it. But as I said, from what I've gathered, everybody is kind of taking shots in the dark, and no one's really sure of when this is going to be released.
Well, the fellow that calls himself the new caliph with the Islamic State Caliphate, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he himself was a prisoner of the United States in Iraq for, I think, about 4 years. I don't know whether he was tortured or not, but apparently that's where he became radicalized. So there seems to be, at least as far as that goes, a pretty direct connection there in terms of blowback.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I talk about this closing the chapter and moving forward, but there is a very good case to be made that you can't really just close that chapter and look at a new one. You know, that everything we've done over there since post 9/11, you know, and prior to that has really led to the current situation that we have. So I certainly agree with you. You can't necessarily separate the report as closing a chapter and then suddenly you're opening a new one. That's just not how it works.
Well, so just how is Dianne Feinstein then handling this? She's always been considered to be somebody that's fairly sympathetic to the intelligence community, and she's been getting a lot of criticism from the left for not going after the NSA sufficiently. But my understanding is that she really is ticked off at the CIA And so is that your understanding?
It's difficult because I think, I mean, obviously you're right. I think that's what makes this so fascinating is that she does have this reputation for being very soft and intelligent. And, of course, her speech in March was a serious departure from that. You know, we saw her go to the floor and basically suggest that the CIA may have violated the Constitution. So we've had these little public grasps of what she thinks on this situation, but I will say that she is incredibly tight-lipped over this. And I, when those doors close on that hearing room, it not much comes out of it from her. And she's very reluctant to talk about it. And I understand that a lot of it happens behind closed doors. So it's difficult to really gauge how she feels on it. But, you know, given her statements in the immediate aftermath of this, you would assume that she's not as keen to be soft on the agency as she has a reputation for doing with the NSA and in these previous instances.
Well, just in closing then, what's your sense then of her recent criticism of the president? It was fairly veiled, but she basically says that, you know, she likes the fact that he's cautious and thoughtful on matters of national security, but she thought that over the issue of the Islamic State, this is a week or so ago when all the criticism was piling on Obama that he wasn't on top of things, that he wasn't a macho enough, that he didn't have a strategy. She sort of joined in that chorus, which didn't seem very helpful, saying perhaps he's too cautious.
Yeah, I mean, I've found that she is an absolutely fascinating politician to watch, and I think because she is so quiet and keeps so much behind closed doors most of the time, when she does make statements like that, even subtly, I think it carries a lot more weight. You know, there were several politicians criticizing his decision, but hers was the one that came up the most in my newsfeed. So I think there is certainly a strategy to keeping these things behind closed doors, because when she has something important to say, it immediately catches the eye of everyone. And I think it really shows that her voice carries weight in this town. You saw it with her criticism with ISIS. You saw it with her March 4 speech regarding this instance with the agency. I think that the best way to put it with her is that when she speaks, people listen.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Ali Watkins.
And, yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, just before I leave you, though, I'd like to get a sense. Do you have any idea of when this report's going to come out?
I mean, I have heard it'll be in a few days to it'll be in a few months to it could be 2018 for all we know. I think at this point I understand it seems that negotiations are still ongoing. You know, I haven't gotten a sense that it's going to come out super soon. But as I said, everybody at this point seems like they're guessing.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ali Watkins.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ali Watkins, who's with the McClatchy Washington Bureau, where she covers national security and intelligence, and she has an article at McClatchy, New Sparks Fly Between CIA Senate Intelligence Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was